From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, with this year's wolf hunt underway here, a leading researcher wants them back on the endangered species list.
We're asking for emergency relisting because that's the only measure that can hold off further hunting until scientists can make a judgment.
Later, where studies of prison rehabilitation programs come up short.
Women were such a small percentage of the population that the guiding principles and the frameworks that were designed for rehabilitation were all based on male samples.
And the important part of the flu vaccine that people sometimes forget about.
Protecting yourself against the flu with the vaccine is important, but also you're protecting your friends, your family, and people you don't even know on the street.
Lake Effect comes your way next after news from NPR and Milwaukee Public Radio. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Wisconsin's third annual wolf hunt is underway. Over 100 wolves have been harvested already, and only 2 of the 6 hunting zones remain open. But long before the 2014 season began, a group of scientists wrote to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to express their concerns about wolf management in Wisconsin. Adrian Trevis is among the co-signers. The UW-Madison Environmental Studies Associate Professor says the Fish and Wildlife Service is charged with monitoring the sustainability of Wisconsin's wolf population during its post-delisting period. Speaking with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz, Trevis explained that requires 5 years of federal scrutiny.
They do have clear regulatory responsibilities for any species that's removed from the list of endangered species. But what does it mean for Wisconsin and for Wisconsin's wolves? Well, it means that the Fish and Wildlife Service has to follow its own rules and some of the rules in the Endangered Species Act for how to monitor the status of the wolf population, its health, and anything that the state is changing or doing differently with regards to wolf management. So I led a team of scientists who were concerned with the last 2 years, actually 2.5 years since wolves were delisted. And this team of scientists and I were concerned that the specific terms of the Endangered Species Act were not being followed closely in our viewpoint, and that state management had changed in ways that concerned us. So we did what really we're required to do, and we alerted the Fish and Wildlife Service to our concerns. But now that the Wisconsin wolf hunt started again on October 15th, and in fact the quotas are almost filled, we felt it's important to remind the public that larger issues are at stake here. And let me start with the larger issue of the Endangered Species Act. This is one of the most popular environmental laws ever passed in our country, and it's recognized around the world as one of the most powerful. It's a shining example of how a government can protect species from extinction. So as a scientist, I'm quite concerned that the terms of the Endangered Species Act are followed closely, and in the context of Wisconsin, the concern about the wolf population is a concern that state management remains prudent, that we don't risk federal relisting under the Endangered Species Act. But for that to happen, several ingredients have to also be included. And those ingredients include the Fish and Wildlife Service monitoring carefully and measuring carefully what's happening to the wolf population after delisting. And the scientists and I wrote a letter expressing concern that the monitoring was inadequate.
Let's go to the point of wolf management in Wisconsin. Is it correct that since the wolves delisting, and of course the first hunt came soon thereafter, but that the DNR here in Wisconsin is in the process of developing a new management plan? Does that agency need to be given time to put that management plan in place, which I think would also set the population number? Should all of those elements be fleshed out and developed and reviewed before scientists say, who have concerns, wait a minute, we're in trouble here?
Well, frankly, no, Susan. It's 2.5 years since delisting, and we as independent scientists are obligated to serve the public with our scientific analyses and interpretations. So 2.5 years after delisting, we should be asking, in fact, every year, we should be asking, is the wolf population being managed and regulated adequately? Is the state management of wolves being overseen and regulated adequately by the Fish and Wildlife Service or not? So in a sense, you could even fault us for having taken 2.5 years to write this letter. But the bigger question here is whether the monitoring is using the best available science. And that's a term straight out of the Endangered Species Act, which reflects the need for monitoring to be careful, sophisticated, and up to the standards of today's wildlife sciences. And the team of scientists that I led found that it was not up to those standards, that the reporting of wolf mortality was inadequately done and not using the best available methods. Furthermore, we don't really have information on whether the wolves were breeding successfully. After 2 full hunting seasons, I would expect a thorough report about whether wolf packs were actually, you know, the majority of wolf packs were actually having pups successfully and rearing them till the first winter of their lives. Without that information, I would maintain the Fish and Wildlife Service is unable to regulate adequately and scientifically according to the terms of the Endangered Species Act. And so this brings up questions about whether the state, as a delegate of the federal government for these 5 years, is in fact managing prudently. And I'd remind the Fish and Wildlife Service, because they seem to have forgotten this, that their responsibilities for adequate regulation last for 5 years after delisting. That means until January of 2017, their obligations persist under the Endangered Species Act. So that's a pretty important step that seems to have been overlooked in the current debate over wolf policy in the Western Great Lakes.
So, Dr. Travis, what I'm wondering about is the Wisconsin's long-standing program of tracking and monitoring. Do you think that system was lacking to start with, or that increased measures need to be taken in monitoring at this point because the wolf has moved from endangered to post-delisting?
That's a great question, Susan. And counting animals is always difficult. It's a very controversial topic in addition to being technically difficult on the ground. For the last 15 years, I've been observing the wolf count, and I participated briefly in terms of getting the training so that I understood what volunteers were being trained to do. I also attempted a few census runs, and they are not easy. They're not in any way technically easy to do for someone who's never been trained before. So I have a great deal of respect for the wolf trackers who've been working, some of them since the early 90s in Wisconsin, to help the DNR count the wolf population. That was a system that I'd observed closely at first hand, and I felt very reassured by seeing pretty much every step of that process done as carefully and conscientiously as possible, until the winter of 2013-14, when the methods changed. And those methods for counting wolves changed substantially. And they changed in a way that made them not transparent, not open to public scrutiny or scientific scrutiny. So that right there is a problem for me. When we change from transparency to concealing information, the public is not well served. Our democratic interests are not well served by a lack of transparency. The Fish and Wildlife Service's rules under the Endangered Species Act, these are rules published in the Federal Register, they require that the states who now have delisted wolves maintain the same monitoring methods to allow interannual comparisons. That means we need to be able to compare the counts of wolves done after delisting to those counts done previously, before delisting. And my scientific conclusion and scientific judgment is we are unable to make that comparison. And we alerted the Fish and Wildlife Service to that fact in a series of letters that you alluded to in August and September. We're basically putting the federal government on notice that their own rules seem to have been violated. We would like to see an independent scientific review conducted of wolf management in the state of Wisconsin so that we can be sure that the wolf population is healthy and safe and secure.
Earlier this week, there was news that of a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service report that indicates that the gray wolf population in the Western Great Lakes District has actually slightly increased over the last year, despite hunts in Wisconsin and Minnesota. The number I read was that a year ago there was 3,678 wolves. This year, 3,719. Does that assuage your concerns in any way?
No, Susan, that doesn't. But I'd have to see where the data come from. So in the absence of the best available science, that estimate of the wolf population in the Western Great Lakes District should be looked at very carefully and skeptically. In fact, independent scientists should examine it to see what it's based upon.
Your group is calling for temporary relisting of the wolves so that this can be sorted out. Is that correct?
That's right. I mean, there's a practical reason, right? We're asking for emergency relisting because that's the only measure that can hold off further hunting until scientists can make a judgment. And scientists, like everybody expects, they need a little time to make that judgment. There's a lot of data to go through. So the emergency relisting allows the Secretary of the Interior to take a step back, allow the independent scientific review to be completed before they continue delisting the wolf. That's a practical reason. The second reason is for the security of the wolf population because nobody wants it to be permanently relisted, which would occur if the Fish and Wildlife Service judged that, in fact, it was again imperiled. Let's step back, hold off, and make sure that independent scientists agree with the judgment of the Fish and Wildlife Service. And by the way, when I talk about an independent scientific panel making the evaluation, I'm not talking about myself or the colleagues that I worked with who wrote these letters of concern. You could say that we're too close to the issue. There are independent groups out there that have the technical expertise that we need to make that evaluation. But I think the main question here, the important question, is whether management of the wolf is being done prudently, consistent with the values of Wisconsin, which includes strong instincts to be law-abiding, whether we're hunters or not hunters.
Adrian Trevis is Environmental Studies Associate Professor at UW-Madison. For 17 years, he's studied the ecology of the wolf's interactions with people and has surveyed Wisconsin residents on wolf policy and management. Trevis, along with scientists from five other institutions, shared their concern about Wisconsin's wolf population with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Wisconsin's third annual wolf hunt ends in February, or when hunters and trappers reach the 150-kill limit. Next on the program, a leader in the study of women and incarceration shares why she thinks gender matters when it comes to prison and rehab. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. WUWM's Project Milwaukee series cast a necessary spotlight on the high rate of African-American male incarceration and the impact it has on the Milwaukee community. While men make up the largest numbers in the prison equation, women end up behind bars as well, and their imprisonment and rehabilitation has a ripple effect also felt in the greater community. A leader in the study of women in the criminal justice system says gender matters when it comes to addressing women, recidivism, and rehabilitation. Dr. Marilyn Van Dieten is an academic who has spent her entire professional career working in issues involving the criminal justice system and, most recently, women in the system. Van Dieten was in Milwaukee earlier this month to mark the 40th anniversary of the Benedict Center, which provides community-based alternatives to prison for women. She tells Lake Effect's Bonnie North that until very recently, there was very little research regarding women and incarceration.
What that means is that we had no way of actually defending what to do with women, because where research funding goes to and where program funding go to are the folks that have the actual research outcomes to support what they're doing. So let me give you an example. We finally have a sense of women in corrections from the 80s to 90s. We know a little bit about their lives because researchers have gone in and talked to them and tell us a little bit about what you're experiencing. But in the 90s, what happened was women, again, small part of the population, criminal justice population. And in the 90s, what happened was we had a group of researchers who put together all of the available research, summarized it really nicely and tightly. And they say, you know, we can actually change outcomes with this population if we do certain things. The dilemma was women weren't included in those studies. They were really not part of the subject matter. Women were such a small percentage of the population that the guiding principles and the frameworks that were designed for rehabilitation were all based on male samples.
And was there a sense that those procedures weren't working for women, or that there could have been better procedures for women?
You know, it's interesting that you say that, because they were working with women to a certain extent. What was really interesting in the years that those principles were being formulated, we had groups, we'd go out and talk about these rehabilitative principles based, again, on male research. And we talked to folks about it, and inevitably they would come up to us after and say, this is great. This is really helpful. We have a framework for our work. But our women look just a bit different. Our women have other issues. So in the models for men, we saw a series of factors that kept emerging. But with women, some similarities and some differences. And the big ones were poverty and trauma and having safe housing and mental health and substance abuse or using substances to self-medicate. So we kept hearing the same theme over and over again from these groups like the Benedict Center saying, you know, we love this evidence-based practice information you're providing us. We like these structures and these frameworks, but again, not feeling it's really truly meeting the needs that our women are presenting with. And so that's really where, you know, our concern came in as researchers. Now, what happened was, as a researcher, folks would say, well, you don't have any research on women. This stuff's working. We're getting some outcomes with them. So how can you say that we should be doing something different?
Yeah, you have no proof.
No proof at all. I mean, we had, again, qualitative data, interviews with women themselves. We had feedback and testimonials from groups. But we really didn't have the hard data. We didn't have the quantitative research. In the last 10 years, we started to capture that. So what's very exciting now is that we can actually prove to folks that when we include items that reflect women's needs, we're better at predicting outcomes. We're better at not only predicting outcomes, we're better at providing services, targeting the needs of women. And we now have programs that were designed from the ground up for women that target the things that women want to do when they come into corrections. And we're getting really nice, solid outcomes. So we're excited about that.
Go back a little bit to what you were talking about, some of the things that affect women coming into prisons, poverty and substance abuse and that sort of thing. Don't those affect men as well? Or
Absolutely.
Are they affecting them just differently?
Well, what we're finding is, and that's a really good point, because again, there's a tremendous amount of similarity between the two groups. What we were looking for is that the programs were all being designed based, again, on male samples. And the dilemma for that is that even everything from program content to the assessments that were being done omitted things like, for example, parenting or asking, why did you start using substances, you know, for women who are self-medicating? And oftentimes what we discovered very quickly is that the pathways for women were quite a bit different. So women coming into the system later, but their problems emerging very early on. So a lot of women reported to us that they experienced trauma and abuse in the family of origin. So a lot of interpersonal and family violence. They had witnessed and experienced those types of things early on. And again, not that men didn't, women reporting this to us and then using drugs to deal with those issues, oftentimes leaving their homes, vacating their family homes for safety reasons to get away from it, and then ending up on the street. So the pathways for women, very, very different than men, or at least the populations that we'd studied of males coming in. So we were missing the mark. We had some of the similarities, yes, substance abuse, and as I said, for men, there's some things that are really important for them too, and there's overlap. But when it came to women, you know, and their needs as they're you know, leaving our programs or leaving facilities, they want to talk about their children. So just picture, I'll give you one sort of classic example. Women come out into the community, and we have probation and parole systems that were designed primarily for males. Start of my career, we didn't even ask the women, do you have children? Like, can you imagine not asking that question to women who are returning to their home, who are responsible for their child, for those children, for their welfare and for their care, and then we're requiring them to come report to us, enter into programs, and we really don't, we haven't even really addressed some of the obstacles to them even appearing for probation and parole. And what we have are women not doing new crimes, but they're not doing well under supervision. So that's one example. There are dozens. I mean, there's literally hundreds of others. Another big one was we didn't know about the impact of trauma within male samples. And some of that is males tend to underreport that. Some of it is, you know, related to the type of research we were doing in that day. But for women, we know that trauma has a longer impact. It seems to have a more devastating and a longer or more chronic impact. And so leaving that out of the picture and not addressing what's happened in the past, which is possibly a pathway to where they are right now, just sort of leaves your entire treatment model certainly lacking.
The data that you've collected now over, you say about 10 years, you've been,
well,
really,
it's been
maybe 20?
Yeah, it's been collected for much longer. I mean, there has been research conducted from the beginning, really qualitative research and some landmark studies as early as the 80s. However, those were primarily interviews and not really based on what we call aggregate data or quantitative data, where we take large numbers of people and we can look for patterns within the data. So we haven't had that until very recently.
And so that data is what is showing you some
of
these.
And that's data that we can give to funders. That's data where we can demonstrate. But now what funders want to see is, are your programs making a difference? Are you targeting the right thing? Can you demonstrate that? And are the things that you're designing for women, are they working?
And are they?
Yes. Yes.
So,
you know, it's interesting. That's, you know, back to your question earlier. Like, I think what's really fascinating about this time period is that, you know, the targets that people say, well, what does that have to do with justice system? It's certainly not in the male data, like parenting, like trauma. We have outcome data now showing that when women receive parenting groups, it impacts how they do in the justice system and how they do when they're relieved from the justice system or leave the justice system. We have nice data emerging on trauma right now showing that if we do treat trauma, if we provide women with coping strategies, that they actually do much better. We have programs focusing on relationships, which is another really large, important target area for women. The whole notion of, you know, oftentimes women coming from disruptive family situations and, you know, reengaging in unhealthy relationships throughout the lifespan. So we see a strong correlation between folks that have witnessed violence in the home, have experienced violence or sexual abuse in the home, and then those relationships, also getting into those relationships into adulthood. And so what we end up seeing is that if we give women skills even to deal with or to develop more healthy relationships, they do much better.
What about the female population in the justice system as a whole? Is it growing or is it?
Yes.
Oh, so we're dealing with more numbers too.
The numbers are larger and that probably is impacting our ability to do research. However, I think we'd rather not have that happen. Yeah, the unfortunate thing is the models that were created, these rehabilitation models, and they're good. They really are. Again, demonstrating good results across the board for males and females. Unfortunately, have an impact in mass incarceration. And that's a really unfortunate thing. And I think, you know, my role is to focus in and zero in on individual change, but we need to do a lot more about structural change because the obstacles that the men and women are experiencing when they leave the justice system or as when they're under community supervision are overwhelming. When you speak to women, like, for example, the Benedict Center right now is doing a landmark project. This is an innovative program with human trafficking. So This can have a tremendous impact on women who are extremely vulnerable, who have lived, who have been victimized and tortured and, you know, abused for years at a time. Often, sometimes these women, they're at risk also for getting picked up in the justice system for various reasons. They come in through the justice system, come into jail, and then we want them to stabilize. But they can't get housing because they've committed an offense that's a felony offense. Then now we've set up a huge obstacle. So a lot of these women end up back in shelters or into unsafe housing where they're meeting folks again or, you know,
Being taken back into it,
yeah. So it's just not safe for them. So housing is a really big piece, huge obstacle for men and women coming out of the system. But it's not just housing, it's finances, it's educational opportunities. Again, all of those things that we take for granted. And there are huge obstacles for them to reenter society. So
it sounds to me like one of the things, and a lot of people have called for this, is like a complete reformation of the criminal justice system and what we consider criminal offenses. Short of that large-scale change, which probably wouldn't happen overnight, what do you suggest, based on the data that you've collected and the work that you've done with individual women and the population at mm-hmm. large, what would you suggest are some of the first steps we can do to help mitigate some of this?
The largest impact we've seen is when criminal justice agencies join with community partners. And we're seeing some really nice outcomes in these wraparound models. Mental health folks did it with assertive community treatment models, and now we're actually using them in corrections, and they're powerful. But what that means, though, is that you have not just criminal justice folks there, but you at the table, you have an array of folks who you bring in labor and housing and substance abuse specialists and trauma specialists, and they all come together to work with higher risk or higher need clients. We're getting tremendous results for that because they can work together as a team to help overcome some of those obstacles. And we've seen that happen. We've seen it with, you know, housing restrictions being removed when community groups get together. So to me right now, that's a powerful piece. It also sends a message to the woman who is trying to reenter the community that, wow, I have a team of folks that are working in a collaborative way with me who have an interest in my welfare.
And hopefully aren't working at cross purposes.
Right, yeah. Right. There is a methodology to them. They're not just, it's not just as simple, we're going to get together and work as a team. They require a tremendous amount of implementation, you know, strategy and commitment from the teams that are there. But we're seeing nice results with those models. Really nice.
So groups like the Benedict Center working with criminal justice, working with other partners, that seems to be the way to go.
From what everything we've seen over the years, yes, because we can contain, we can still do these little, like, for example, we can give each individual woman access to a parenting program or a cognitive skills program. And that's great. It gives them coping strategies that they can mobilize in troubled times. But if you have a woman who has a long history of need or is facing complex mental health needs, they need something much bigger than that. You know, they need something, a program that's going to wrap around them and, you know, really help facilitate change. And it means that all of these systems have to cooperate together. And, one example that we were talking about earlier today, here's an example where a woman has a strong need, has a, you know, serious addiction, a history of addictions, and is placed in jail and then comes out on the street. And if we don't have supports there for her that are going to address that need, and if she slips up in the short term and we send her right back to jail, like we keep doing that, this revolving door kind of thing. If we continue to do that, she doesn't have much of a chance.
So what is next for you in terms of research? What are you focusing on in the coming years?
One of the big things is the entire, I think, punishment model. There's a tendency in the work we do that the second someone slips when they're in the community, that we should send them right back. And that really concerns me for women and men as well. But my research is with women. And what I've heard women say is that sometimes it takes up to a year for them to actually trust the teams they're working with or the staff member they're working with. A year to stabilize with housing, to perhaps reconnect with family members, to feel confident around their children again, to feel that they can stabilize and not use. So if we continually, every single time someone makes a mistake, send them back, we're sending them way back. we're putting them through all of these disruptions, and not just their families and their relationships with their kids, but it's a huge disruption in their life again. They're going back, readjusting to inside. And I think that's an area that we'd really like to focus on.
Well, Dr. Marilyn Van Deaton, it has been such a pleasure having you on the show. Thank you so much for your work, and thank you for coming by.
Thank you.
Dr. Marilyn Van Deaton is a Toronto-based clinical psychologist who specializes in criminal justice and incarceration issues, especially related to women. She was in Milwaukee earlier this month to mark the 40th anniversary of the Benedict Center. We'll take another break now and then look at how Wisconsin is doing when it comes to influenza prevention. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Tyke. Ebola has once again risen to the top of newscasts and the front page of newspapers after a doctor returned to New York City from West Africa infected with the disease. But doctors and public health officials around the country say they wish a similar state of alarm would exist over the upcoming flu season. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says deaths from flu complications in this country can hit 50,000 in an especially bad year and still a few thousand in a good year. Dr. Mark Hermanoff is an allergist and immunologist and heads up Aurora Healthcare's Influenza Care Management Initiative, and he joins us on the line this morning. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you.
What demographic group is least likely to get the flu shot, and why?
Probably the least likely group to receive the vaccine are young and healthy adults who feel that they don't need the vaccine because they're young and healthy and never are getting ill.
Well, and so then let's address that. You're young and healthy. You don't get ill very often. What is the compelling reason to get the flu vaccine?
So there are several reasons to get vaccinated against the flu. First of all, it will protect you from catching influenza, which could knock you out of work for 7 to 10 days. Probably more importantly, though, is that influenza sometimes causes complications in your own health. It can put you in the hospital. It can lead to more serious illnesses like pneumonia. And in addition, when you catch influenza, there's a several-day period of time where you're asymptomatic. You don't have any symptoms. You feel fine, but you have influenza, and you're spreading it to others. And that's where you can really go on and hurt other people. So if you're around someone who has a chronic illness, or if you are friends or are in contact with someone who's pregnant or who is undergoing chemotherapy for, let's say, cancer, you can make them sick, put them in the hospital, and they can even die from complications of influenza. So protecting yourself against the flu with the vaccine is important, but also you're protecting your friends, your family, and people you don't even know on the street.
This is the underrated part of the flu vaccine, I'm guessing, this idea that just because you are young and healthy, that does not mean the people around you are young and healthy.
That's right. And if you get the flu vaccine, you're going to be protecting yourself, and you're going to be protecting the whole community. So you're helping yourself, but you're also helping everyone around you.
Well, and so who is most at risk from the flu?
So the groups of people who can have the worst complications from influenza are, first of all, pregnant women. So when you're pregnant, your immune system is kind of turned down because you're growing a baby inside you. And when you're doing that, you're at risk for other illnesses. So if you catch influenza when you're pregnant, it can make you very sick, but also can lead to complications for the baby that's inside you. In addition, if you have any kind of chronic medical condition, so if you have asthma, if you have heart disease, kidney disease, diabetes, all of those conditions can be made far more severe if you have influenza, if you catch influenza, rather. Finally, if you're older, if you're above the age of 65, you're at higher risk for complications. And in fact, people who are over 65 don't respond as well to the flu vaccine. And so it's important that those people who are around them, who have exposure to them, so young adults and kids who are around their grandparents, let's say, that they're protecting themselves from influenza, but they're also protecting their grandparents from getting ill.
So you are helping lead the influenza vaccine initiative within the Aurora system. How well is Wisconsin doing in terms of people getting vaccinated against influenza?
Well, it depends on if you feel the glass is half full or half empty. The half empty part is that only about 47 or 48% of people in Wisconsin get the flu vaccine. So, you know, over half the people in our state are not vaccinated, so they're not protected and they're at risk to catch influenza and spread it to others. The glass half full is that, you know, healthcare providers are starting to get the message at Aurora Healthcare. About 98 to 99% of our employees are vaccinated against influenza. So, you know, we're very pleased that we're able to, you know, protect all of our employees, but more importantly, by protecting our employees, we're protecting the public who interacts with us.
Does herd immunity come into play when you're talking about influenza?
Absolutely. So if only a few percent of the population has the vaccine, then everyone else around them can still get ill. But once you get to a certain level, probably around 75 to 80% of the population getting vaccinated, then it's much less likely to spread from person to person because the vaccine is very effective. It's not perfect. So even if you have the if you get vaccinated, if you've got everyone else around you vaccinated as well, the vaccine is far more effective than if just, you know, let's say 20% or 30% or even 45% of the population is vaccinated.
Why do you think it is that people seem more alarmed by, you know, two cases of Ebola in this country than they are about the number of deaths from flu each year?
Yeah, it's hard to understand why people read about something happening in the newspaper and don't think about what's much more likely to hurt them. That probably has to do with human nature than it has to do with logic. You know, there's thousands of deaths every year in this country from complications due to influenza, and yet people are worried about things that are far less likely. Which is, you know, you can worry about lots of things in the world, but there are certain things you can do something about, and one easy way to prevent influenza is to get vaccinated.
Let's talk briefly about the vaccine itself. What is the distinction between an inactive vaccine and the active one?
So the majority of vaccine that people receive is inactivated. So that means that the virus, it's a dead virus. It can't interact or grow inside your body. So it will teach the immune system, this is what you're supposed to look out for, immune system, and this is what you're supposed to respond to. So when you get exposed to the real influenza virus in the world, your immune system's already seen it before, and it's already mounted a response, so it's easy for your body to fight the infection. An activated vaccine, which is the nasal vaccine that's available for most children and people up to age 49, is a flu virus that's been weakened. So they've taken out the parts that make people sick and just left in the parts that stimulate the immune system. So the virus gets sprayed into the nose, and it will grow inside the mucosal membrane of the nose and lead to an immune response, but it won't make you ill.
Is there a compelling reason to go with the flu mist versus the flu shot, or is it really a matter of being put off by what can be a painful shot in the arm?
Well, certain groups of people are not candidates for the flu mist, for the nasal spray, because they have weakened immune systems or they have asthma, so they can't receive the vaccine. In addition, it's not approved for patients over the age of 50. So if you're in those groups, you can't receive the nasal spray. This year, the CDC is beginning to recommend that you know, children who are healthy, who can receive the nasal flu mist, should consider getting that first, because there's many reasons to believe that is a more effective vaccine, especially in that group of patients, in children and young adults. So if you can get the flu mist nasal spray, it's certainly something you can consider. It's not always available in all age groups. And again, there are certain groups of people who can't receive that vaccine, have to receive the injectable form. The truth is, I got my vaccine in the arm yesterday. It really doesn't hurt very much at all. So I'm biased towards getting a shot, but you can get whichever one you prefer.
The flu season tends to last, if I understand correctly, it can run really from September through May. How long is the vaccine effective? If you were vaccinated at the very beginning of flu season, is it likely to be effective right up until May?
It is thought to be effective all the way through that whole period of time from September until May. You're much more likely to catch influenza at the height of the season, which, you know, can range from December until March. But it is perfectly fine to get the vaccine even in late August or early September. It will offer you protection. The thing we worry most about is, you know, if an opportunity presents itself to get the vaccine, you should grab it then, because you may not be able to get it later. Something may come up. You may forget about it. There could be a shortage later. So it's better to, you know, whenever you have the opportunity to get the vaccine and get yourself protection. For this year, the vaccine is the same vaccine as last year. So you're boosting your immune response by getting a second vaccine in the fall. And even if you got the vaccine last year, you should still get it this year, because it will eventually stop being effective over several months. So if you got the vaccine, let's say, last fall, you do need to get another vaccine this year.
Well, Mark Hermanoff, thank you so much. Hope it's a quiet season for you.
Thank you. I hope so, too.
Dr. Mark Hermanoff is an allergist and immunologist and heads up Aurora Healthcare's Influenza Care Management Initiative. There is a link to more about that and flu information in general from the CDC at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. One last break, and then we'll travel to India in the early 1960s and chat with the author of a series of books set in a watershed time for that country. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. The India we see in books, movies, and television feels like an exotic place. Certainly nothing like southeastern Wisconsin. But the India of Betsy Woodman's novels might seem more familiar to a Wisconsinite and, at the same time, exotic to people living in that country today. The books are set in a small Indian town in the 1960s, a town that has plenty in common with small towns here and much of the world over. Woodman is a New Hampshire native but spent significant time in India in her youth. And while she is not the model for her protagonist, Jana Beebe, the setting is very much inspired by her own experience. The latest novel is called Emeralds Included, and Betsy Woodman stopped by the studio on a recent trip through Milwaukee. Nice to meet you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much. It's really a pleasure to be here.
So this is the third Jana Beebe novel, and while they all take place in India, this is not the India that is so often portrayed today in popular culture, the impossibly crowded Mumbai. It's not the Taj Mahal. Give us a sense for this town where Jana lives.
It's the 1960s, which means that there are half the number of people in India that there are today. So that automatically makes it a little different. And this is a hill station. The town is a hill station.
And what's the significance of a hill station?
Hill stations were resorts during the British time where the British went to escape the heat. And after independence, they evolved into full-fledged tourist centers. And so today, the town that this is modeled on is a very bustling center, and it's just a very, very popular resort. And in Jana's time, India's already independent, and there already is some of this tourist traffic, plus a few leftovers of the Europeans and the British from the days before.
She is what people would generally refer to as an expatriate.
Well, she's an Indian citizen, actually, in the book, because she has grown up in India and only had one little period of her life when she lived away in Scotland, was miserable, and did everything she could to come back to India as soon as possible. So she's more like one of those staying on characters. And she's very Indian, actually. She's not going to live anywhere else. And that's just where she feels home. That's where she wants to be.
And as you say, this is the early 1960s. India is starting to, but hasn't really yet come into its own on the world stage.
It's already pretty important in that India is trying to be the non-aligned nation. This is the height of the Cold War. So they do not want to kowtow to anyone. They will have friendly relations with the Russians, with the USSR and with the USA. They will not be dictated to. And they also want to be seen as a moral force.
And as you say, this town is based on a real-life hill station, correct?
Yeah.
Jana, however, if I read correctly, is not necessarily based on anyone in particular.
She's totally fictional. She just sort of marched into my brain one day with the parrot on her shoulder, and there she was.
Was this the India of your own youth?
Yes, it was. It was. I went at age 6 and stayed – well, my family stayed for 10 years. And so all my formative years were there in elementary school and most of high school.
What was that like for a 6-year-old from New Hampshire?
That was what was real life. India was what was familiar, safe, comfortable. And it was the States that was exotic and a little scary and not very familiar to us. So, you know, India was where we lived.
Well, so but what was it about India in particular? If my research is correct, you also spent some time in France and in Zambia, but you are not writing about those places.
Well, I was in India for a lot longer. Also, I think India, once it grabs you, doesn't let you go. And that can still remain true 10, 20, 30 years later. And
what was it that spurred your parents to move there?
Oh, my dad worked first for the United States Information Service, which was the precursor of the USAA. My mother had trained as a ballet dancer, and when we got there, she made friends with our next-door neighbors who were dancers and film actresses and performed and later had a ballet school.
Did they see it as an adventure in any way?
They did. They did. They were small-town New England kids, my dad from New Hampshire, my mom from Massachusetts. They wanted to see the world. This opportunity to go to India came up. And in those days, it was a lot further away, a lot more exotic. The relatives were scandalized. And my mom had 2 little girls, 6 and 4, and she was 7 months pregnant with another. And the relatives said, you're not going to go have a baby in India. She said a lot of people have had babies in India.
Well, and so in this latest installment in the series, Jana is anxiously awaiting a visit from her son and his fiancé,
right,
who are still in the UK. It strikes me that Jack, her son, and Katerina were kind of seen as celebrities by the people in the town.
Oh, yeah. They were given a big welcome, which would probably have happened.
Well, I was wondering if they're in a way, as New Englanders who had transplanted there, whether you were in any way a celebrity.
Well, my parents were very, very social, so they just had a gift for making friends. And my dad hated the sort of Cold War stuff and said, our job is to make friends. And what could be more fun? So he went at it. They went at it with a lot of enthusiasm. And because, you know, we met the wonderful movie stars, that just sort of rubbed off. And people always treated us with incredible hospitality.
Well, and that was one of the things that strikes me about the many Indians that inhabit this book is that there is a certain, you know, it's not really a deference, but it's a hospitality is a good way to put it.
It is hospitality. And there is an expression in India, guest is God. So you're going to treat them well.
Jana obviously could go back to Scotland if she wants, but as you said, she doesn't want to.
Yeah.
I wonder if Jana's staying in India helps you in a way stay there.
Well, Jana rehabilitated me to India. I hadn't been for a while. Since leaving at age 16, I'd been back a couple of times, and I had read hundreds of books about India. And then when I got this book contract, I really plunged into the research. And the interesting part was that today you can research something set in the 1960s much, much better than you could have in 1965, just because all the electronic resources are there. Netflix with all the 1950s and 1960s Indian movies. I became a sort of a Hindi film addict. And, you know, old BBC archives. We're living in the golden age of research. So,
did you find that the real India of the 1960s, as you researched it, mm-hmm. lined up with your memories of the place?
The real India, there is no one real India. You know, there were
But the mind tends to you know, you look back on things through rose-colored lenses, is the cliche.
Yeah, yeah,
did you find, as you look back into what times were actually like at the time you were there, did they line up with your memories?
I think a lot of the images did bring things back and did make it clear and also gave me a feeling of authentication, right? Emails I've gotten from the Indian audience, the books are also published in India, say, oh, yes, this is right. This is how I remember it, too. So, yeah, I've just gotten a feeling, oh, phew, I'm relieved that, you know, I didn't blow it.
When you talk to your readers, I mean, most of them, I would imagine, at least the ones who are reading it in this country, did not grow up in India. What is it that appeals to them? Why do they connect with this series of novels?
Well, I've tried to make it actually an easy entry into India, and I do use some Indian words, say Hindi and Urdu, and there's a glossary.
I found myself consulting it a number of times.
Yeah. But there's a lot that's kind of universal. What's a small town? People, even the ones who live in cities, many of them have a little hankering for that small town in their imagination. And so it's a place where intimacy is possible, eccentricity is possible, and everyone knows everything.
I was just going to say, you know, whether you're in India or in Scotland or in the United States, in a small town, people know each other's business.
Right. My dad used to say about New Hampshire that you learn about your indiscretions on the way home from having committed them.
You obviously write about a lot of these characters, even the ones with sort of foibles, with a great deal of affection. Who are your favorite characters that inhabit these books?
Well, the tailor, Feroz, is one of my very most favorite. He's the philosopher who writes little notes down in his notebook along with the measurements of his his customers. And I do love him. He was traumatized during the partition of India and Pakistan, so he doesn't want to take a train trip. And let's see what else. He can't quite keep his family under control. His nephew wants to be a singer for the movies. And even though he doesn't like all these things, he does manage to forgive and, accept and tolerate it all.
Jana, popped into your mind how long ago?
About 4 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, yeah.
And so you have been presumably living these books in the time since. And I know Jana is not autobiographical, but I wonder if there is any sense of life imitating fiction. Do you feel like now that Jana is part of your life, you have Jana moments?
Probably do have Jana moments. I sometimes I think, now what would Jana do? She's a lot more adventurous than I am. So, I tend to be a little conservative. And then, don't be a wimp. Jana would just go ahead and do this.
So do you have additional Jana adventures already coalescing in your mind?
Actually, there are tons of subplots that didn't make it into any of these three books. They're there, and who knows when the characters are going to rattle their cages.
Well, it is a delightful world to be immersed in, and it was delightful to chat with you. Thank you so much.
Delightful for me, too. Thank you, Mitch.
Betsy Woodman's latest novel is called Emeralds Included. It is the third in her series of novels featuring the character Jana Beebe. Betsy Woodman lives in New Hampshire. She was in Milwaukee recently for an event at Boswell Book Company. Our interview first aired last month. And that is another week's worth of Lake Effects, produced by a team that includes Dan Harmon and Bonnie North, along with production assistants Eleanor Peterson and Audrey Nowakowski, web assistance from Michelle Maternowski, and studio engineering from John Strelecki. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for listening. I sure hope you'll be with us this weekend. We're on Saturday and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, your NPR station in Milwaukee. Keep listening. Right now, it is 11 o'clock. Fresh air comes your way next.